And so I'm currently teaching audio, game audio and interactive music at the Center for Digital Imaging and Sound up in Vancouver as well. And I used to work for Electronic Arts, Radical Entertainment, a few other places. The most recent sort of bigger title that I worked on was doing the audio driver for Need for Speed Hot Pursuit 2. And I've also done professional composing, so I'm also a signed artist to a German record label. And after I finish this conference, I'm going to Germany. So I'm going to be going to Berlin, Hamburg, and Munich and doing some stuff there. So the basic point of this talk is that within game audio, there's sort of a fundamental split. We've got composers on one side, you know, the creative types. Well, I'll go to the next slide here. We've got code, you know, coder, composer, and they're sort of, you know, there's this big gap in the middle. And one of the little tricks I was thinking of doing is like, okay, who's female? Hold up your hand. Who's male? Hold up your hand. Okay, who's both? You know, and it's one of those things. There are certain things that are, you know, there's a grayscale in between, and there are certain things that aren't. A lot of the times what happens, is, especially in bigger production teams, is that you get slotted into very small areas. So you're only the composer, so you don't have any say over what happens to, you know, necessarily so much to do with the code. It's kind of like, this is my vision, but, you know, whatever, you don't get to necessarily talk to the coder that much. And a lot of the talks that I've heard have been, there's a huge problem with having contractors doing audio, because a lot of the times they don't get access to the coders. So definitely something that it's a huge problem. But what I'm going to try and do is that I've already, you know, whatever, there's sort of the proceedings, and there's a like a 12-page sort of paper on this. And so what I'm going to try and do in this lecture is just sort of talk about a few examples and sort of say how to break down this barrier. Because, you know, you've got coders on one side, and they're, you know, whatever, they're pretty smart folk. And like myself, I'm somewhat both, I guess. Actually, maybe we'll do that. A show of hands. Who considers himself like a coder? Okay, lots of coders. And how about composer? Okay, that's good. And how about neither? Okay, that's great. Good, good. Both? Anyone? Few people? Okay. Yeah, because we're, you know, we're all people, and we have talents that fall into many different areas. So it doesn't make sense just to sort of shut down one side of your brain just because it's like, no, I'm the composer now, and so I'm just going to be able to do this. So it's good to approach this problem of game audio from both sides. And it is, you know, the title isn't so good, so if anybody's here for aesthetics, sorry about that. It's sort of, I really dislike the word content, so I tried to figure out something else to put in there. But it's a little bit odd. So rather than thinking of these as two different things, we've got, basically it's all together. So that's the most successful audio that happens when you've got, in the old days, actually I'll just go back here, in the old days it was sort of like one person, and now it's many people working together. And so what I've done is I've tried to sort of adopt a somewhat of a software engineering-ish approach and talking about sort of process levels as far as how these two correspond, and sort of trying to adopt a little bit of a formalism there as far as how to see the problem. Because it's all well and good to sort of say, well, this is sort of what happens, and, you know, sort of say that these are problems and maybe these are some solutions. But one way of seeing it is that, okay, how proactive are you about doing the audio? So I've sort of divided into three levels. This is sort of based somewhat on the software capability maturity model. There's probably a few people that know about that. I sort of tried to make it a little bit simpler. So basically, we've sort of got short term, so that's more sort of pragmatic. You just work on what's right in front of you. This tends to happen a lot. Unaware of most existing practices, misapplication, because you sort of understand sort of some theories and whatnot. And you just sort of do what you can to get the deadline done. And as far as a theoretical standpoint, it's gonna really bite you later on if you just hack things, basically, from a code perspective. And then we've got medium term. This is where you've done a little bit of research into process, so maybe you're applying some software engineering principles, or maybe, you know, a compositional theory, or maybe you're, you know, getting into stuff with you know, film production, where you're applying some sort of model so that you're using some sort of theory to guide your process. And then the sort of level three is the long-term idea, where you're proactively developing techniques that are going to make things even better in the future and work specifically for the problem that you're working on. So what I'm going to do now is go through sort of a few areas of game audio that are tend to be sort of typical problem areas, and then sort of try and break them down with examples in these three sort of different levels. So I'm going to talk about prototyping, peer review, audio control parameters, voice and memory usage, tools, and automated mixing. So these are sort of areas that I've found, well, I found a few good examples anyways, but I definitely find that these are core areas to game audio that have been problems for me, and I've seen them as being problems in the past. So a little bit of history. In the good old days, you've got the coder/composer, like, you know, Rob Hubbard. He's, you know, whatever, he's contractor guy. He spends like 16 hours a day in front of his computer, you know, whatever, editing hex bytes. But at the same time, he's a musician and creating stuff that way. Then in the 1980s, you've got the rise of FM, and you know, there are no more PC system beep and MIDI musicians. And then it goes to streaming and sort of PCM audio, where you've got Pro Tools musicians coming in to doing video game audio, and then sort of where we're at now, where you've got a lot of film composers coming into the industry because, well, there's money. Maybe they want to get out of what they're doing. I don't know. I'm not. I am composing for film right now, but it's you know, I'm coming at it from the other way, so I don't know the mindset. So this is obvious, whatever, some statistics. And after working at EA for a while, it seems that with Electronic Arts, they sort of break their production into two halves, where you've got the marketing side that's sort of, or the, you know, the production side, the, you know, rah, 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 management as far as coming up with ideas and whatnot. And then you've got the actual development side that actually sort of does the grunt work and whatnot. And then the two sides are sort of modeled to be somewhat antagonistic, I guess, but it does seem to be a fairly film production model. And that's the people that they're hiring, especially in the studio that I was at. So I think that for me, I found that to be a bit of a problem because I have a bit of a, you know, I have a comp sci background. And yeah, games are not movies. They're interactive. There's a lot of problems that happen, especially in a production viewpoint. That, you know, whatever, with film, it's like, what are you going to do? You do an IMAX or a 35 mil, and, you know, whatever, surround. With games, you've always got, it's like, okay, you've got four platforms, so, you know, what kind of code base are you using? You know, there's always going to be bugs. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't really happen so much in film. So we've got more money, so we've got bigger productions because we're trying to get more revenue. And so we have more people coming in, and so there's more gaps. And so we need to try and bring these gaps together. And with game audio, it's sort of that fundamental gap between sort of the composer, musician, you know, the content person, the creative type that has the vision, and then the coder that actually implements the code and the control structures that actually render the audio. So these are just some, some ideas of solutions. So yeah, narrow and bridge the gap. View the problem as a whole rather than trying to say, okay, I'm just an artist or I'm just a composer. So, you know, there has to be some learning on both sides to try and figure out a common vocabulary so that the process can go faster and more clearly, and so that the, you know, it becomes more artistic and just better. So yeah, open process. And the idea is not to force one side into the other. And this is a something that I definitely found was a possible problem, is that you can create tools that allow the composer to do stuff that's pretty much like code. Like, say, if you've done audio scripting and you're a composer, you could really get into it. But it can make it that it's, you know, you can lose focus as far as, like, okay, you're creative and you can do the code, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you should. Not to say that you can't, of course, but it's sort of using both elements to their best to create a whole that really fuses together and works the best. And so, yeah, don't pigeonhole the employees to say, like, oh, wait a minute, what do you mean? You've got, like, the coder coming up with an idea saying, oh, yeah, well, we're mixing this wrong, or there's something that we can apply here that would actually really work well. And to sort of shut down communication or ideas at that level is not a good idea. So another weird word, renaissance, just to sort of kick that off, bring things together, rethink about it. Art and science, renaissance idea was that they were sort of somewhat one thing. And so that's what I'm sort of trying to say here. Prototyping, so a level one prototype quickly built and awkwardly evolves into final project. Level two prototype is made and thrown out, which is what a prototype should do. But a lot of people say, well, you just threw that out. It's a waste of time. I've had that happen as well. Level three, you make rapid prototypes and you document what you've worked on so that you can look back and say, this is how we got to this actual prototype. And, you know, the final is built from the best elements of those. And as far as an example, I'll just go with the level one. And what I was definitely sort of guilty of when I was working at Modern Groove is that I used I just verbatim, I needed to get some streaming sound happening, so I just used the Sony example code, but it was only for mono sounds, for mono streaming, and it needed to be stereo. I didn't quite understand it, so I just sort of jammed and hacked it together so that it would work with stereo. And of course, instead of actually looking at the code and understanding it, I sort of left that code pretty much prototype code that I should have really reevaluated and learned and threw away, and it sort of stayed in until the final little bit. And then, of course, I was doing weekends. It's just like, okay, now I need to actually know what the heck I did here. So that's a definite pitfall. So one thing that you can do as a composer is use sort of, in a sense, from a software engineering standpoint, this is like using, in a sense, case tools. Like you use a way to rapidly produce environments in which you can model your audio. So with, say, doing engine sounds, you could use a reactor to produce some sort of a synthesis model. Pure Data and Max MSP. Do people know what Pure Data and Max MSP are? Kind of? A little bit? Okay, basically it's like you've got little object boxes and then you have little patch cords and it's like a modular synthesis system. It's very similar to Reactor. Have people used Reactor at all? A little bit, somewhat. Okay, good. And Audio Mulch is sort of it's a smaller program, and it works the same way. And these are programs that I teach my students with, and they're entirely just musician/engineer types. And using these programs, they start learning programming control structures without even knowing it. In a sense, I mean, obviously they're in the class, so they know that they're learning something. But it's actually quite useful, rather than saying like, okay, you're a composer, you know, whatever, you're going to take a few C++ classes. It's like, you know, it's not really the idea. It's like, use it for, you know, whatever your subject area, right? So these are fast ways to develop models. Editing, many sketches, throw out non-essential elements. And when I talk about prototyping, I'm talking about, like, if you're a composer, I'm talking about, in a sense, doing working sketches where you come up with a lot of ideas and throw out things that don't work. It's the same thing on the software engineering side. Strengthen and underline the key elements and have someone that you consider a friend review it so that, and it doesn't necessarily need to be someone that really knows, you know, in depth, you know, whatever, like a composer type or something like that. Just somebody that you can bounce it off to, because a lot of the times you'll find like, oh, okay, I actually have rethought what I need to edit out because I need to present it. And that's actually a great thing about, well, presenting and teaching is that you have to know it, right? So that's something that's great that I find for editing. So I already sort of explained this, prototyping traps, attachment to the final, attachment to the prototype into the final project. Focusing on the easy problems, this is what we also did at that same company where it's like, okay, well, we need to do dynamic loading, but it's not really that fun, so we're just going to leave that to the end. And that was really bad. And also, say if you're doing demos for producers, a lot of the times what can happen is that you can add bells and whistles that you can be really wasting your time on non-core issues. So this is peer review. People give periodic feedback. Closer and composer primarily work separately, and this is sort of a state that contracting composers can somewhat be in if there's not really good communication. Level two, peers regularly evaluate audio, describing good and bad points. So when you give review, it's sort of like doing a postmortem as far as the Gamma Sutra style. It's like good points, bad points, so that the person being reviewed knows that, okay, well, I'm getting slammed for all this stuff, and I kind of know that. I wanted to do that better. But at the same time, when you have stuff that's good, then they can say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to keep that. That helps me. And level three, composer and coder receive and participate in open peer review, and they also self-evaluate, like themselves, and also each other, and they can work together in a synergistic manner. Okay, and peer review, overview. Reviews are often tossed out when schedule looms. I found that basically I had done one audio review and then I was like, okay, that's great and fine and dandy. Now everybody get back to work. And what can also happen is that similarly, oddly enough, people just say, I just want to be on my keyboard working. And another thing is, yeah, I already sort of explained that point. So yeah, acknowledging good work, like having proper review and critique is a really important thing. And with larger sort of companies and corporate structure, that can actually be really difficult because you've got this built-in hierarchy, so it's hard to figure out what, you know, in a sense, where the peer structure is, because it can be a lot of like, you know, you should be doing this. And that can be a problem. So the advantages are you can catch early design flaws, identify pipeline bottlenecks, and inspire confidence, like I've been saying. So learning, you're sharing information, ideas, and process, avoid hiding and covering up mistakes. This is kind of like closed source stuff where you've got, I don't know, Microsoft, you know, releasing service pack after service pack, and it's just like, well, geez, just, I don't know. Opening things up can be a good thing. And bridge gaps, which is the core of this talk, and an open avenue to getting help. A lot of the times I found that even though I was working on audio, and a lot of the times there's only one audio coder, so you can feel a little bit like, oh man, well, I need some help here. And so what can happen is that if you've got a peer group that happens to include someone that, you know, respects you and vice versa, say a lead coder, you can actually learn a lot that way. Especially I learned a lot about coding style from a lead coder. Audio control parameters, this is how you derive parameters from the game. Level one, sound tags are placed by tagging animation frames in a text file. Oh, that's pretty scary. Level two, sound tags are placed directly in animation by artists, and then also derive some of it from the game state. Level three, additional AI layer is added between game state and audio to make parameters possible for a composer to use. And I'll expand on that by saying, say you've got a system, whatever system it is, be it scripting or some other tool, that the composer can actually use to control the behavior of their audio. Something which I was working on, which is quite important, is say you're getting parameters from the physics. It's very important to normalize those so that the composer looks and says, okay, well, I'm going from 0 to 100%. I'm not going from like minus 0.24 to like, you know, whatever, plus, you know, 32768 or something like that for my input. So it's good to normalize the parameters. And sometimes if you've got a logarithmic input, sometimes it's good to sort of flatten that out so that you're not, you know, if your range is from 0 to 100%, it's not like you're sticking in the lower, you know, 10% for 50% of the time. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. All right, so there's sort of two methods here. We've got game state, deriving parameters from there. That's sort of implicit. So the good thing is that it's flexible and reactive, and the bad thing is that when I was working on a racing game is that you're at the mercy of any game changes. So, you know, if the physics gets overhauled, you have to go back and change stuff. And the second thing is that sound tags, which are sort of explicit, the good thing is that they're reliable and clear. You know what's going to happen. You know, tag, you hit the tag, boom, you've got some audio happening. But the bad thing is that to create really reactive and sort of immersive audio, you have to add a lot of tags, and that can be quite difficult. And that, it can be a little bit simplistic sometimes. So authenticity. So this is basically talking about don't be stuck into saying, like, especially from the coding side of you, it's like, okay, I've hooked up these parameters, and, well, you know, composer, go for it. You got to somehow figure this thing out. It's like, what really needs to get done is to use those parameters in a very musical way. Like, if we're thinking visually, the way that I try and visualize game audio, it's like, you've got the content, which is kind of like an instrument, you know, and then you've got the code, which is kind of like, you know, a player, you know, so it's sort of like you're, to create game audio, it's like you're sort of jamming in a sense, you know, you're trying to create something that is producing something which has some sort of emotive content to it, but at the same time, it's bounded in technology. And to just say that the technology is entirely driving it, it's like having a robot playing a, you know, a clarinet. Maybe you program the robot really good, but it's something that really needs to be thought about. So, yeah, say like with 3D audio, it's like, sure, maybe you plug it in and hook up all the parameters, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it sounds good. So as a game coder and also as a composer, it's good to make sure to push that you're not just working off of the technology entirely. Voice and memory usage, level one. Composer has no way of knowing what they are, so he uses a spreadsheet. I've done that. Level two, composer is provided a runtime memory map and voice utilization output. They press a button, they can see what voices are being used and see how much memory is being used and which samples are using it. Level three, the memory map uses some sort of statistics. So if you've got, say, multiple regions in your game, you've got, well, in the case that I worked on, you know, you've got a car type, and then you've got the location, and then maybe you've got, like, button sounds, like front-end stuff. So you've got three different banks, three different regions, and saying, okay, this region uses this percentage of memory, this uses this percentage, and if you combine that with statistics that say, okay, this is how often this sound gets called, then the composer can run the game for a while, pause it, and then say, oh, okay, that's interesting. Well, I've got this, you know, this bonfire sample that only plays once every so, you know, once in a while, and maybe I should actually look at that. Maybe I'll reduce the resolution of that. Maybe I'll, you know, shrink the time on that, or otherwise maximize out the memory. So that's a tool that is pretty useful. So yeah, obviously it can be a very sore point between the composer and coder. So a lot of the times the composer is working in the dark because the coder is just trying to hook things up, never mind trying to get debug audio or debug output happening. And then, the coder can get pretty bitter because it's like, man, you keep on blowing the memory. Why do you keep doing that? It's like, well, yeah, composer, but if they're shooting in the dark, how do they know? You know, what are they going to do? Continuously like, okay, I'm going to reduce my sample set by 2K and see if it fits in this time. Well, so that can be pretty frustrating. I'll just talk about a few ways to reduce voice and memory usage. Volume culling basically means if the volume goes down to zero, then you get rid of it. Usually you have to envelope it. Sound sphere reduction, if you're working in 3D, make the sound sphere smaller. You know, if you've got a hockey rink and you've got sounds emanating off all the players, and you know, you've got the listener actually placed on the ice, just, you know, whatever. If you want to reduce the number of voices, make the sphere smaller. Then there's voice stealing. You use a priority mechanism. Depending on the priority, it steals the lowest priority voice. Instance capping means that you use a group of samples, and you construct some sort of an idea of how to group samples together and basically say, all right, what I've got here is I've got, say, a machine gun, and so I'm going to have four slots for my machine gun samples. And so in that case, you're capping your instances at four. Submixing means that if you've got two sounds that play together at the same time a lot, maybe you just put them in one sample. And then usable runtime statistics. So that just basically means what I was talking about, where you dump out the memory, the composer can see like, oh, okay, I've got all this memory available, and oh, geez, well, maybe we can reduce, usually it's on the side of the game audio coder, but you know, maybe reduce the size of streaming buffer or something like that. It's important to have the composer so that they can see how much memory they have, obviously. Tools, composer is given a text file to tweak volumes, pitches, and other parameters. Composer is given a GUI to modify parameters at runtime and a compiled scripting language. Level 3, composer is provided a graphical object-oriented environment, that's like Reactor, Pure Data, Mulch, Audio Mulch, which they can tweak at runtime, as well as using interpreted scripts. And when I say interpreted, that basically means that you can put the script in, it'll run, and then you can change, without stopping the game, you can put a new script in, and then it'll also run. Of course, for the coders in the audience who go, ah, but it's not optimal. It's like, well, yeah, well, whatever. Do a compiled binary or something when you're, make a release version of it. Tools, common problems, usually they're in an alpha state, i.e. they barely work. It's like you get the audio coder and they produce an audio tool. It's like, oh, okay, it works. Now the composer can start using it. So, and yeah, that's it's always fun. And often there's no schedule for tools development. As an audio coder, it's kind of like, okay, we're almost finished this project, so finally I can do something fun and start working on tools and try and cram that in before the next project. No QA. Yeah, usually there's, and that can produce a lot of antagonism where you've got the composer is just saying, excuse me, could you fix, there's a really small problem here. I just can't quite use your code. So that can be really annoying if the audio coder is halfway through stuff and it happens a lot. I mean, they only have themselves to blame, but still, it's difficult for the coder to come up with real world test cases that actually make sure that the tool works. And maintaining tools, like I said, it can be not very much fun. And tools reuse, coders always think they can do it better. They look at a code base and it's like, oh yeah, well that tool, no, I can do it better. And oh, existing, you know, like MIDI, yeah, but MIDI's slow, so I'm not going to use that. If you've got something that's related, it's sort of musical, it's related to time, just, you know, whatever, MIDI is a great format. And then you can use a third-party tool like Cubase to generate data. So as far as an example of this, for Modern Groove, what I did is that we had this BJ system where it got 3D objects spinning around the screen, you know, whatever you smoke up or something like that, and sit down and watch your PlayStation 2, the idea was to figure out a way of cueing audio events to cause reactions in the 3D objects. So what we actually did is we went through all the Ministry of Sound tracks and produced parallel MIDI tracks, which would actually, in a sense, it's like audio scripts, and so they would trigger certain behaviors in the 3D objects, and that was super easy for me. All I did is just take, you know, the MIDI, and then I found a program that would convert it to text, and then from there, just, you know, do a little bit of parsing. And I didn't have to construct an editor at all, and the best thing about it is that I could just get, we were able to contract a guy just, you know, that knew how to use Cubase, and then they were able to crank out these scripts in, you know, 4 days or so. So it's good not to reinvent the wheel. Learning curve, often it's obvious for the coder who created it, but not the composer. A lot of the times there's no time to actually get trained or, you know, get sort of a lead in. And it's good when making tools to test it with real-world data from last project. So don't just be nice on yourself, especially if there's, you know, no QA, to just say, okay, well, the tool works with these very basic cases. But then it's really about putting real-world data through it. So using the data from the last project can be really good. Obviously, a lot of the times the code or the data changes, but that's one approach that can work quite well. So I've talked about these sort of tools which could possibly used to be used for audio tools. And I use these in my own composing, but I've not actually used them as tools in game audio yet in a real way. So the idea with that, in a sense, would be when you're playing around with a max patch, that it would actually run on the game audio side at the same time. So you're modifying parameters in real time. Say you're constructing an engine model. You've got the engine model on your PC, goes over to the debugger, which goes over to the console, and you can actually change the behavior in real time. So that's something that I've been thinking about. But then the problem with that is that when there's more control for the composer, that can also bite into their time, and also not only just for doing it, but for learning it and then also maintaining it. So when I'm talking about these two sides, it's where to draw the line as far as workload. So if they work together, you know, these two people work together really well, then they can figure the best way of splitting the workload. So go on to automated mixing. And this is basically where you've, instead of having sort of static levels set for your game audio, especially say if your sports game is a great example, where depending on almost any other game that's really quite immersive, kind of requires a lot of thought put into changing the mix levels at runtime. So you've got more players on the ice, it's going to be louder, so maybe you want to drop down the relative levels a little bit, or maybe there's only one player, maybe you want to focus on him and bring up the levels a little bit. Whereas if it's all statically mixed, it's going to sound quiet with that one player, and then it's going to maybe, you know, whatever, distort the system if you've got a lot of characters on there. So with automated mixing, first stage level here is audio content is integrated by Coder, and this is what also happened on our project, is that a lot of times audio Coder will just get snagged from somewhere and they actually want to be doing something else, and they might not have a good sort of musical background, and so they won't necessarily think, okay, well, just putting in levels that are static isn't necessarily the best way to go, and they throw things together and it gets implemented and hooked up, but it's not dynamic, and it's a huge problem. Level two, the Coder creates real-time faders for a composer for runtime tweaking. This is nice because you can have instant satisfaction of changing the levels, and maybe you've got a system that can actually, maybe even crossfade between them, but it's quite useful for that, and I worked with a system like that, and it was great for tuning engines, where what you can do is that, say, you've got the low, mid, and high, and for the composer, they can just mix out the top two in real time and say, okay, I just want to work on the low revs here. And that is really quite useful, rather than having to go to the Coder each time and going like, can you put in some flags or, I don't know, some, you know, hash defines so that I can actually tune my audio because I can't hear what's going on here. Level three, the composer is provided a system where they can define the behavior of the audio mix. I don't know, I somewhat consider this somewhat of an advanced idea. How many composers have worked with a system where they can actively change the behavior of the mix? A few people? Okay, that's good. Yeah, because I think that this is definitely something that's it's quite important, but it's also quite difficult. So with mixing, like I said, a lot of the times you'll get producers that'll be just like, okay, so are all your sounds hooked up now? It's like, okay, well, they're kind of hooked up, but I haven't mixed them yet. It's like, okay, well, what does that mean? And usually what'll just happen is like, okay, well, that just sounds bad. It's like, well, it's not mixed yet because this is really loud because, you know, whatever, I got that sample, I don't know, whatever, from the previous version of the game and, you know, whatever, I L1 the hell out of it, so it sounds bizarre, you know, in this context. So, you know, that's that can definitely happen. And so it's not acknowledged as a major issue. Sort of the final mix for a film is a pretty huge thing, but in video games, a lot of the times it's just like, okay, well, we've got the game pretty much working, and you've got it all mixed, and then, of course, you know, there's always, you know, whatever, the physics changes, or you get licensed music, and that's what I'm talking about here. Licensed content is usually late. It's difficult to get. With the Ministry of Sound, I think we had 2 weeks from our original production cycle to jam it all in. We'd used a lot of placeholder stuff, but you can imagine, because we were having such a tight correspondence between our visual playback and the audio, it was quite important. So that was quite interesting. Of course, our project got delayed a few months, so we're able to work that out. Licensed music, it complicates the mix. And with working on the racing game, the problem with this is that you can put as much placeholder in as you want, but then when you get, I don't know, whatever, maybe you've got Yanni in there for some reason, and then you get whatever, a Nine Inch Nails track, and it's like, okay, are you going to have to change your mix? Probably. Yeah. So another thing that's pretty important is to try and get is the freedom to master. In other words, be able to do, if you've got, with the racing game, you got cops, and so you've got a lot of mid-range content, but for the licensed content, it's going to be full bandwidth. It's going to be, whatever, radio-friendly. So it's just going to be like, pipe cleaner. And are you going to be able to hear the speech without it just frapping out? So if you get the leeway to actually just, scoop out a midsection of it, that's a really great thing to be able to do. And also be able to maybe get rid of some of the subharmonics and other stuff that might, conflict with stuff like road noise or other things. Or maybe entirely you might want to drop the road noise out, but, that's so I sort of touched on this before. So with digital mixing, out of headroom, L1 it, woohoo! And with licensed content, it's pre-mastered. So the difficult thing with digital mixing is, okay, I've got a lot of sounds and I'm running out of headroom and I need to add just one more thing. I need to add this crowd chant that'll, put this soccer game just like through the roof. And it's like, and then it starts just totally distorting. Oh man, what am I going to do? And if you don't have, say, that fader system or some other way of easily just grabbing, groups, virtual groups anyways, on the audio side and bringing them down and being able to say, okay, I want to, in a sense, duck. So that's automated mixing. Duck everything out and bring this in and bring the focus in. Then, that's going to cause horrible problems. And that tends to happen a lot. So the mix on a lot of video games is not so good. And that's just sort of a side topic, the idea that there's no video game mastering guidelines. Like film, television, you've got a certain decibel level where you've got your speech, certain decibel level where you've got your ambience, music. But with video games, it's variable. Do you master it so that if you pop out, your game and then you put in a DVD, is it supposed to sound the same? Or, whatever, if you're, if you've got a, a war sort of themed video game and you want it to be pounding right off the start, is that a good thing too? Or do you master it to the sound of, the chime at the start, like the PlayStation 2 sound, do you master it to that? Don't know. L1 it's basically a compression sort of scheme where you bring up a lot of the, you bring up a lot of the lower levels and try, it basically just makes it, it increases the RMS, like the sound. But unfortunately, it distorts the audio a lot if you really press it. So it's basically a compression sort of plug-in. So, it's an easy way for sound designers and composers to say, okay, I've got licensed content, and now I've got this sound that's not compressed, and so I want to make it so that it competes, and a lot of times it'll get L1'd, and especially if you've got a team of people, you've got somebody that's working in speech, some, licensed music, and then you've got the composer that's maybe working on the ambiences, they're all working apart, and they're all working on the game, and they can compete. Where they're using different levels of compression, and that's not necessarily the best way to do it. You want to actually have a little bit of breathing going on in your game rather than just, if you're looking at the output, that you don't want to just have it entirely maxed out all the time. A TDM or VST plugin, with automated mixing, you either use code scripting or some sort of GUI to decide the mix level. And it is a difficult topic, I think, because what you really want it's you know, if you're looking at it from the film sort of perspective, it's kind of like, how would you make it so that it's almost like there's somebody actually working the mix? Like, it is a performance. And to code that isn't easy. Yeah, I mean, it should at least be addressed so that it's not like you've got nobody at the mixing board. Like, you know, would a film ever be done that way, or you just leave everything static and then hope that it all works out? So that's automated mixing. And so as a composer, so once the mix is automated, how do you mix it? Because where's this line between, you know, the coder and the composer? Like, if the coder is coding some stuff that does some automated mixing, and then you're the composer and trying to figure out, okay, now where's my mix at? You know, this is a definite problem. So what has to happen there is a lot of communication, and also just a basic vision on how you want the mix to sound and how it should all integrate together, so both people are on the same page, or, you know, the team of people are on the same page. The automated mixing definitely needs to work. There's no sense in putting in something and then not having it sound good, which can definitely happen. So, and so as far as future topics, we'll be getting into more real-time synthesis, custom real-time DSP effects. You know, that's obviously possible on the Xbox already and PC. Making the samples less static, so we'll be able to do stuff where you can actually change formants. You'll be able to do more intelligent spectral crossfading. You'll be able to do real-time time stretching, and also modulation. So say you've got you can dynamically change these as well. So say if you're doing an engine sound, what you could maybe do is just time stretch it, you know, so you could do techniques like that would contribute to your audio. That's a horrible example, but there's a good example out there somewhere. Okay. So is this a new burden for the composer, all these new technical sort of topics? Personally, I don't think so, because we've got, you know, whatever, like synthesizers, you know, digital synthesizers have been around for ages, right? You know, you get your control panel, you do what you need to. Obviously, there's not so much an idea of, okay, well, I need to figure out a way of not having me touch it and having it produce some sort of emotive content, but there's definitely a lot to be learned from what's already been done. You know, like how many, not as a challenge, but I mean, really, how many composers need to really know, you know, the whole thing and whatever, like how FM works. It's, you know, it's frequency modulation. Like, it is important, or granular synthesis, or, you know, techniques behind, like formant shifting or something like that. It's good stuff to know, but if you've got really good controls over it, you don't necessarily want to get into the guts of it. You just want to do your job. Like when I'm doing composing stuff, you know, I don't want to take the top off of my Z1 and like look inside and go, oh wow, that's great. Yeah, that's doing a great job there, and all nice, you know, nice leads there. It's like, you know, you don't need to do that. There's no sense. So there's sort of levels, and that's what the Reactor and Max MSP are actually quite good at, because they can break things down in a modular level. And Reactor does that in a very graphical way. It has all the control structure sort of hidden, and then you can create this front panel, which is very analogous to an actual hardware synthesizer. So I think that's definitely going to be something that's going to be happening a lot more. And so, conclusion. So, as I'm saying, don't be stuck in your job title, you know, composer, coder. It's a spectrum, right? You know, and it has a lot to do with communication and figuring out what your vision is for the game audio. And so there's two things, you know, we're all creators in a creative process. You know, video games, they're art, right? They're a, you know, a cultural product. And also, we're all engineers in a software engineering process. So even though, you know, as a composer, maybe you're not thinking, okay, well, I can't necessarily do what the game audio coder does, but at the same time, you know, the composer is spending tons of time at a PC, whereas if you talk to, I don't know, whatever, say a less, someone that's not necessarily entirely in this sort of industry, and, you know, whatever, classically trained violinist or something, you know, you are, you know, an engineer in this process. You know, like, there's a lot of stuff that you're doing that, you know, in a sense, even regular musicians wouldn't be doing. So you're already, you know, like, if you consider this being whatever, you know, Tibetan throat singer or whatever, you know, I guess it's Tuvian throat singer, versus on this side where you've got, like, you know, the super nerd or something like that, you know, you're already at this point, right? So it's kind of figuring out how to join the two together. So yeah, I'm just saying, jump in, try something new, and have fun. And so that's what that's why I'm still doing it. I sort of started, I guess, I started my degree in 91, but I sort of started my co-op stuff in 94, worked on NBA Live 95. So it's been almost 10 years that I've been sort of playing around with this. And yeah, I mean, if you're not having fun, then what's the point? So I'll just open it up to questions. Oh, there must be some questions. Okay.
Well, I just kind of noticed with, say, not point fingers or anything, I just find it interesting, if I was throughout music, that approach towards creating interactive music seems to me interesting in some aspects, but also it's like micromanaging every single little aspect of control.
Yeah.
You know, are you familiar at all with the program Live?
Yeah, Ableton Live. Yeah.
Live. So I'm just kind of thinking of like a program, an interface similar to that, that can change, you know, like Acid, but maybe taking a step further, where you can have instantaneous key changes, tempo changes, etc., and be accessing plugins and things of that nature that further modulate and control that sound.
Yeah, so in a sense...
It can be linear audio.
Right.
It does not have to be a MIDI thing, because quite honestly,
yeah,
a lot of those soundtracks that are incorporating a lot of MIDI, to me, sound...
Yeah. So basically what you're talking about is a granularity. So you've got on one side, you've got, okay, great, you know, big deal. So you can modulate around, you know, A minor or whatever for like 5 minutes. You know, who cares? Like, what does it mean? You know, that's like, you know, it's like aleatoric music. Like, you know, what's the point? It's like, sure, you can do it, but is it emotive? Like, you know, you've got the computer, you know, deciding what all the parameters are and working it all out. It's all fine and dandy, but does it mean anything to the listener? And I don't think it does. So yeah, you need to break down where your granularity is. And I think that, we were just talking about this earlier, that say with, there's games that, you can even do like orchestral scoring and have an interactive score that way, where, you know, say a process for that would be that, you know, you've got this person that can produce orchestral music, but they don't necessarily need to be the person that's actually cutting up the sections and working with it and putting it all together, right? So it's this thing of, you know, it's like art, right? It's not, we're not trying to, you know, be all wanky and say like, oh great, you know, whatever, I can do like a circle of fifths and it's like never, you know, whatever, it's never the same. It's, you know, there's no point to that. You know, it, just because you can doesn't mean you should, and but it's definitely figuring out that granularity, because it's like, okay, if I play a chunk of music for 2 minutes, you know, whatever, maybe there's, you know, whatever, like, when you hear the first three bars of that, maybe as a listener you go, okay, here's the fourth time around, I know what's going on. But maybe if you broke that up into four pieces, you hear the first three and you're like, okay, I know what's going on, and then it shifts to the second part and you're like, oh, okay. Now you're, you know, as a listener, your ears kind of go like, okay, that's, you relax a little bit, and it's like, oh, that's, you actually listen.
There's a lot of control that can be had with plug-in-based, you know, CPU processing on linear audio. It doesn't necessarily have to be MIDI, you know, because you can even tweak sounds. If you have any experience using plug-in like that, you can really do a
And that's just going to get better with time, you know, like with processors, you know, and the new consoles and, you know, whatever. That, all that stuff is definitely going to be, you know, it's going to be happening. More questions? Yeah. Well, okay, I think it's getting better. I think that, yeah, game tools are getting better. Part of the reason being that, well, I don't know, I guess I've worked for a sort of a fairly large company, I guess, and so with a large company, you can devote more time to tools. But also what's happening is that you're getting better third parties, you know, third-party developers that are middleware solutions, basically, that are getting even better because they're getting more evolved and, you know, whatever, the sort of more scrappy ones, you know, they're falling to the wayside. And then what will happen is that, say, for a smaller developer, you know, it'll become more realistic to just say, okay, I'm going to use RenderWare Audio, say, for sake of example. I'm going to use that, you know, because it works, and it works across all platforms. I don't know that it does, but, you know, anyways, that's... I do believe that it's going to get better, especially with, you know, there's, in a sense, almost competition from the other side of things, where you got composers, they're using Ableton Live, they're using Max MSP, they're using Reactor, you know, these kind of technologies, they have to, it has to happen. Yeah, just because there's going to be more control that has to be mastered, you know, it has to be utilized, because there's going to be people pushing the envelope. And, you know, if you don't do that as well, you're going to fall behind. Yeah, more questions, please. Any comments at all? What I tried to do with structuring this talk is that, I've gone to a few talks and tried to, you know, at some point I'm trying to explain a little bit of a formalism, but then also give, you know, somewhat examples as well. So I don't know how well I've done that or if this is sort of considered somewhat useful. But, you know, there's also a paper that's like a, whatever, the GDC submission that I've done, and it's not the PowerPoint presentation, it's actually like a 12-page sort of thing that sort of goes into a little bit more detail. So if you're interested, you know, that sort of extra knowledge there. Well, I guess it's going to be in the book. And apparently, actually, it's on the proceedings. Yeah, I think that it was on there. So that's some good background information if you want to sort of fill that in. I don't know, do you consider these, I don't know, it's difficult to sort of not just whine all the time and say, oh, these are horrible problems, audio gets ignored, and I was going to do a little bit of that. It's just like, okay, well, we got to start thinking about like a little bit about the future, and so that's what I was trying to break apart with level one, level two, level three. It's like level three stuff, I haven't necessarily done it, but I consider that to be a current direction with my knowledge right now, that's what could be happening in the future, or what already is happening. And you would know about that. The comment there was that the problem being with tools is that, you know, like as a parallel to film, we've got 35 mil, whatever, 16 mil, and, you know, they're set formats, and they've been around for a long time. It's not like we need to refigure all that kind of stuff out. You know, there's definitely surround sound that's a little bit different. But with game audio and just video games in general, we're constantly having the rug pulled out from underneath us. It's like, oh, here's a whole new system, you know, and the hardware barely works. All the documentation is written in Japanese. And, you know, all your tools just go out the window, right? So, but I still hope that what will happen is that... even, yeah, like say with a larger company, like at EA, you know, things have to be cross-platform, so they design their tools to be cross-platform. And somewhat, you know, this idea of, in a sense, being stuck in the past, yeah, that is a byproduct of, you know, whatever, you're just running to keep up with the platform. And it's like, you know, if there's differences between platforms, you know, like you have time to implement those, right? You know, it's like, okay, PlayStation 2, that's whatever, 70% of the market, so are we going to spend an extra 25% of our production schedule on these few little, you know, bells and whistles for Xbox? No, that's a difficult balance, and definitely that didn't happen. But it's also kind of saying, okay, well, hopefully this is what will happen as well. So hopefully what will happen is that, in a sense, middleware will become, you know, there'll be sort of bigger companies there that will happen, and they'll be able to crank this stuff out faster enough to have an actual really strong tool set to really, you know, grab the newer consoles by the chips. So, yes. Yeah, that is a definite problem, and that's sort of talking about the tools and sort of, in a sense, you know, when you work at a company, it's kind of like, okay, we need to actually make these tools custom for our application, and that is difficult to constantly make tools like Ableton Live, you know, on a production schedule where it's like, okay, we've got this new platform and we need to crank this, you know, this game out in 6 months because it's going to have to come out before, you know, whatever, to be ready for the movie and launch. So yeah, these are sort of systemic problems that I've been somewhat ignoring, so it's good to bring those up though. So, should I take one more question or just wrap it up? Oh, okay, I'll take another question then. Anyone, one more question? Okay. Yeah, that kind of stuff is yeah, it's huge. Basically, the comment was talking about taking the content further, I guess, with real-time sort of DSP processing, and I guess that's only going to get better. So, say, one thing that I was thinking about for doing speech is that with our, you know, whatever, with certain, you know, whatever compression schemes, and also, you know, if you're able to change the formants on the fly, then say what you've got is, you know, say for example you've got a cop dispatcher, right? They can be male or female. And if your format shifting algorithm works really good, you know, and it doesn't take up too much time, what you can actually do is reduce your data set and not actually record two different voices, or you can actually morph in between them. Because it's not necessarily a primary character. It's just something that maybe you don't want to hear, you know, this precise woman's voice all the time. You could actually shift the formants and say, okay, you know, as a listener, it's like, wow, that's someone else talking, right? So that's kind of stuff that I think will also happen as well as far as real-time DSP stuff. And that's, you know, that's a totally applicable example. Or, you know, like, yeah, you know, like spectral crossfading where, you know, speech stitching is, you know, it takes up tons of time, right? If there was an automated way of doing that and doing spectral crossfading in between it, wouldn't that be great too, right? So I think I'll just wrap it up there. So if you've got questions for me in particular, just, you know, talk to me. I'm here for the rest of the thing, so thanks.